Welcome to Strange Familiars, covering a range of topics from the paranormal, cryptids, mythology, the occult, hauntings, UFOs, weird history, and folklore. Wherever you are listening to Strange Familiars, iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, or any other service, please subscribe and click the like button, and share the Strange Familiars pages and stories on Facebook and other social media. If you have experienced something strange, or if you know a story you would like us to cover, email strangefamiliarspodcast@gmail.com or find us on Facebook, facebook.com/strangefamiliars. And of course, you can always find us at strangefamiliars.com.
Welcome to Strange Familiars. For those of you who are interested in my music, I have a new CD album of folk songs coming. I should be releasing that in June. The songs are, for the most part, about various topics we cover here on Strange Familiars. So it's kind of paranormal folk songs. Some of the songs were written about personal experiences I've even talked about on the show. So if you follow that closely, you might recognize some of the stories in the songs. The album is called Fallow. I'm also releasing a 5-inch lathe cut record at the same time. This will have two songs that are not on the CD. This record is called Haint. There will be 25 copies only of this record. Strange Familiars patrons will get the first shot at the records. I will put a patron post up soon with a link to somewhere you can reserve a copy. Lathe cut records, for those of you who are not familiar, are individually cut records. They're not pressed like normal vinyl. The sound quality isn't as good as a standard record, but I think of these as kind of an audio artifact. The music, when you buy the record, will be made available in a digital form, in the form of a 3-inch CD that will come with the record, and also a digital download. So you can listen to the lathe cut record if you want, or the digital version on CD or download. Speaking of music, I'm going to compile all of the ambient pieces I've done as sort of background and mood music for Strange Familiars, and release that as an ambient album as well. That should be coming very soon. That will be a free download for patrons if they want the download. If you want a physical copy, I'll have a discount for patrons. But the download will be free for patrons. Just another advantage to being a patron. As far as my writing goes, I have upcoming pieces in Fiddler's Green number 5. And Woodnock's Journal of Bigfoot Research, Volume 3. My Woodnock's piece concerns Delta, Pennsylvania. Really excited that this is finally seeing print. It goes into some very, very strange things, all locked into 8 square miles of York County. Speaking of Bigfoot and York County, I've taken a large number of Bigfoot reports from York County already this year. As time goes on, you'll probably hear us talk about some of those on here. I was at a witness location on Wednesday. James K. and James R. will be with me. We'll be heading out to another location later tonight. These are just two of many reports that we've been given, not to mention possible ongoing activity at Site 7. If you've witnessed Bigfoot or anything strange in York County or elsewhere, drop us a line and let us know about it. StrangeFamiliarsPodcast@gmail.com or 717-347-8554. You can text that or call and leave a message. On tonight's show, we're going to be talking with two guests about more strange lights. First, I'll be talking with Jerry, who'll tell us a story about seeing a weird light in Iceland, closely associated with the legends of the Alfs or Elves there. Jerry and I also talk about anomalous lights in York County, the Brown Mountain Lights, which he's also seen, and more. A little bit later, Matt comes on and describes a UFO he saw, as well as some other strange occurrences in the Sierra Nevada Mountains. Welcome to the show, Jerry.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You live somewhat local to me. You don't have to be super specific.
I don't mind, but more or less. My wife and I work down here in Washington, D.C., but we have a house up in the Avenues in York, which is sort of right in Central City. We've been there about 9 years. Yeah, this is our 9th year. We've got one of the creepier houses there in downtown, so we're pretty happy with that area. So I think we're probably almost right on top of each other.
We share some stomping grounds.
Yes. In fact, I keep expecting that I'm going to pull up one day and we're going to run into each other in the woods in the middle of the night after you know, listening to this thing. In one episode, you mentioned some drones, and I was like, oh, was that me? Because I have a drone that I take out. And I was like, oh, I think I sent you a note and said, well, I wasn't out there on that date or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. And you actually gave us some good information on drones. I know virtually nothing about it, and I think James didn't have – he was going from what someone else told him. You know, I don't think James claimed to be a drone expert either, but he didn't have all the facts right. You actually gave me a lot of good information on that. You told me a story about some lights, but it was not even in the United States, right?
Yeah. I don't have a French accent, but I do have a story that doesn't take place in the United States. And let me give you a little background, if that's okay.
Sure. Yeah.
I've been interested in what I guess you call it the paranormal for probably going on about 30 years now. I think I did my first investigation in a serious way when I was about 14, 15 years old, and I'm 44 now. And I grew up in Texas, and most of the stuff I researched was sort of our legends down there. And I wrote a few pieces on the Aurora UFO crash. My wife and I investigated that when we were dating, and the now famous Goatman's Bridge. I was the first person to sort of debunk that story. That they, much like Toad Road, it's one of those stories that no matter how many times you debunk it, they keep telling it over and over again.
Right.
And I did a lot of that kind of stuff, and it sort of became a hobby for us. And I call myself a skeptical investigator of claims of the paranormal. I primarily am a skeptic. I'm a scientist by profession. I have a bachelor's in anthropology and a master's degree in history, and my doctorate's in a field of adult education. I'm a data scientist for the government. So I'm kind of a grounded guy, but then I have this sort of foot in legend tripping, and my wife's and my primary hobby is doing this kind of stuff. We don't go to travel to lay on the beach. We go to places, Gokikihara Forest, the catacombs of Scotland, of Paris, the vaults of Edinburgh. Like, we don't just go to a place to go there and sort of lay out vacation. We sort of go to Urbex and Legend Trip and that kind of stuff. And that's what ultimately brought us to the York, Adams County area. Is if that's your hobby, like, it's like living in the Bermuda Triangle, between Gettysburg and York and Philadelphia. You got all the... you're never hurting for a place to look. So, I'm not coming at this as a guy who, has had no experience in this. I've done a lot of cases of, traveled all around the world over the last 30 years. And so we've had a lot of experience with it. And one of the things that I've always been interested in is the legends of the Fae folk. And I think you've talked about that a little bit.
Sure.
We've been to some of the Fae sites in Scotland and in England, and the real hotbed of Fae stories is Iceland. They call them the Huldufólk there, and in the Faroe Islands, they're the Huldufólkshja, and they're basically, the old name for them was the Alf,
yes,
which means elf. And you'll, Alba Twitch, maybe we can talk about that a little bit, but I have a theory, and I think you do too, that might be the origin of that name.
Mm-hmm.
But they have this real strong belief system that they're still sort of these little people that exist in the, in the crevasses and mountains and stuff around Reykjavik, and then in the center of the island, and to the point that they even move the ring road, the one, it's not an interstate because there's no states, but the one road that goes around the island, to avoid an area where the Huldufólk live. The word Huldufólk means hidden people, hidden folk, and they use that word to avoid using their ancestral name of elf, because that's supposedly bad luck. And one of the things they do is they build these sort of faux houses for them all over the island. They put out offerings, milk, bread, liquor, that kind of stuff for these guys. In Reykjavik, when you go around the park, you'll see them, and they're very touristy. But I shot you over some pictures of some of the old, more authentic ones, including one from a place called Kelder, which is a farmstead that's been occupied for 1,000 years. And so, they have this spring, and they've built an elf house there. And that's where we had our experience. We went to Iceland the first time for my 40th birthday. So that was February 4 years ago. We were there in the middle of winter. We wanted to see the Northern Lights, and we wanted to sort of explore these elf huldufólk legends. So the way, you know, we always start our adventure is usually in a bar, right? So we get there day one, and, you know, we're looking around Reykjavik, and we, you know, I'm kind of a beer connoisseur. So again, York County's perfect place to live if you like craft beer and mysteries. We find this bar. I won't give the name of it, but you can find it because it's the only craft bar in downtown Reykjavik. It's moved since then, but it's next door to it used to be next door to a place called the Hotel Blue. So anybody who's in Reykjavik can track it down. And we're there. It's the middle of February, total off season, bitter cold, but there's no snow on the ground. And we walk into this bar, and some other American tourists were there. There were just four of us in the bar, and we're hanging out talking. And it's me and two other ladies and my wife, and they're all having a good time, and we're cutting up. And as often is the proud tradition of ladies who travel, they all go to the restroom at the same time and leave me and the bar manager to talk. And we're sitting there, and I said, hey, man, you know, he's got nothing to do, so he's drinking, I'm drinking, and he's sharing with me his homebrew. Like, we've got enough of a relationship going that the guy's giving me beer out of his private stock. And I'm like, you know, I want to ask you about this elf thing. Is this true? Is this BS or is this true? And Icelanders are extremely matter-of-fact. They're even more matter-of-fact than Germans. And he goes, oh, yeah, it's absolutely true because I've seen them. And he said it just like that. And I said, what? And he goes, no, it's true. I've seen it. And I said, well, what's the story? And he goes, well, there's a place where we do food and beverage tours at a thing we call the Crystal Cave that's out on this road that takes you to the local airport, not Keflavik, which is the international airport now, but the local intra-Icelandic airport that was built by, I think, the Brits during World War II. And again, you can find this on the internet. I'm not going to give away directions to this guy's site, but if you really want to find it, you can find it. And he goes, we do tours out there, and I see him at night. I'll get out there at night. The sun, you know, in the wintertime sets at 3:30, 4 o'clock. So it's already dark when he's setting up, and he says, and the way I see him is I see these lights that move up in the hills and in the mountains and in the valleys, and they'll move along like lantern lights. And he said the old people will tell you that that's how you see the huldufólk, because what you can see is the lights from their houses and from the little lanterns they carry. And I said, that sounds ridiculous. And he says, I don't know what they are. And we started speculating, and he's like, it could be some natural phenomenon that we just call elves. It could be something related to the volcanoes or something like that. And I said, well, that's anomalous phenomenon, so, you know, let's try to check it out. So a couple days go by. We've rented a car. We're exploring the island. We had not gone to this site yet. We were going to save that for our last day because it was the closest one to the hotel we were staying in. And I'm also big into Icelandic culture, and I always wanted to go out to some of the sites that were in the Poetic Eddas, the Icelandic Chronicles. Yeah. And we were doing a day like that. We needed to go out to Keldur, because that's one of the places, if you are familiar with the literature, that's heavily mentioned in Niall's saga, the saga of Burn Niles, which is one of the longest ones, place that was actually there. So the buildings that were there when the saga took place. It's the middle of winter, of course, tons of snow. And again, I've sent you some pictures you can share. There's nobody around at this major tourist attraction. So we spend the whole day out there, sort of hanging out, having a good time. We ended up, you know, staying out very late because our real goal is to see the Northern Lights. And Vicky suggested, well, this place would be perfect. We should come back at sundown to check out the lights. Go into town, have a couple of Viking beers, eat some French fries, go to the local bath because everybody takes a bath. You know, we do the bath, and then we head back out to Keldur. And we're sailing down this dirt road towards the site, you know, to get into position to check out the Northern Lights and see if they show up. The cars work like American cars. We've got a white, I think it's a Toyota. Vicky's driving. I've got cameras in my lap, so I'm ready to take pictures thinking I'm going to check out the Northern Lights. Got a, you know, a 35mm Nikon camera. Sailing down the road, out of nowhere, maybe 25, 30 feet off the right of me, as we're driving down this dirt road, a ball of light appears, little bigger than a basketball, smaller than a giant beach ball. It's orange, like fire, and it is bright enough and high enough off the ground to cast a shadow. So Vicky and I both saw it. She almost wrecked the car. She slammed on the brakes, came to a roaring stop. I tried to get out of the car. I was so freaked out and ecstatic. We weren't scared. We were ecstatic. I couldn't get my seatbelt off. By the time I get the seatbelt off and the door open, it goes out. So I literally started cursing. Like, I was furious. I was like, we're never going to see this again. Like, we saw the thing we came to see. What are the odds? And we've been back to Iceland since then, never seen it again. And we're not going to get to see it again. Just as I get out of the car, maybe another, 500 yards, 300 yards back off into the field again, out to my right, it appears again. It's too far away at this point for me to, see it as close up as we saw it before to see if there were any defining characteristics. But it's the same light, about the same size, off in the distance. And I had my camera in my hand, and at that point, I snap a whole bunch of pictures, just as many as I can. Get a bunch of pictures taken. I sent you probably one of the better ones.
Mm-hmm.
Get a whole bunch of pictures taken. It goes out briefly, and then it shows back up in an almost the same position. And I try to chase it. I tear ass out across this gully, because there's a, much like an American, Iceland is devoid of trees.
Right.
So this is almost like being in West Texas. It is well below zero. It's icy slick. I climb down the side of the road, and I run headlong into what we would call a deer fence. Just slammed right into it. I start trying to climb it. I can't get over it. They have reindeer there. I can't get to the other side of it. And I was so pissed off, I started yelling at the thing. I was like Vicky gets out of the car. You always hear about people who have paranormal encounters being very chill and relaxed. We were not. We were howling like maniacs. So if this thing had been a person, or something like that out in that field, it would have, we would have scared.
Yeah, it would have at least recognized your presence.
They would have recognized. Yeah. And then it goes out again. We continue to see it on and off, I would say, for probably the next, it seemed like 5 hours, but probably the next 10 or 15, 20 minutes in that sort of same area. I don't get any more pictures that look good. At this point, it's so cold, it's draining my batteries. I go to get my video camera. My video camera, which was in the trunk, the batteries are dead. I think I maybe got one blurry phone pic. So that initial series of pictures from the second time it showed up, the only time I saw it.
Now, when you say that your battery was drained, the cold drained your battery?
Cold drained our battery. Okay. We had that problem. This was not paranormal. This was February 20th, and this was a brutal winter. So it was like if we had ran out of gas, we'd have been dead by the time we got back to the highway. It was that cold. Mm. So batteries were gone. We had that same problem when we were photographing the Northern Lights. We really only had about 20, 30 minutes before we had to switch batteries with warm batteries to keep them going. So that sounds like the weird part. We're not to the weird part yet. I have on a hat at this trip that I'm very, very fond of. It's a British fat flat cap, brown knit cap, very warm, like a faux silk lining. And I'm wearing that hat before we leave that spot. We spend the rest of the night driving up and down that road. And I mean the rest of the night until probably 3-4 o'clock in the morning. That's how much we were into it. We were trying to find side roads to get closer to where this thing was, just anything we could. Another car never came. We never saw any other houses. We never had a reason to get out of the vehicle until that point. We are exhausted, and we have this long, grueling drive back to Reykjavik. We have to go over this major mountain in the middle of the night on the frozen road. We get back to our hotel. We crash. Neither one of us can sleep. We hit a couple of drinks and talk about it, finally fall asleep. We get up the next day, and I'm like, well, what do you want to do? And she goes, I want to go back out there because I want to see, were there lights? Were they burning off natural gas? Was there a geological formation? She's like, I can't let this rest. Let's get some food and get back out there. We get up, and I realize I don't have my hat. I've got my parka, I've got my scarf, gloves, no hat. We get back out to the site. I'm like, well, I'll at least be able to get my hat. Get out, no hat. I'm like, okay, the hat's gone. I lost it somewhere in the middle of the night. We take some pictures of the area as best we can. There's no houses there. There's no side roads, no features, no phone poles, nothing. You know, like here, like in Texas, you know, you might expect a some old farmer's light or something on a well house or something like that. This was just empty land, and clearly the guys got it fenced for caribou, and I don't think caribou light up, you know, like balls of fire. So we spent another hour kind of roaming around, looking around, kind of making peace with it. We're like, well, let's go back to Kelder, and we've got some snacks in the back. We'll eat a snack. We pull up to Kelder where the, you know, where the visitor center is. Still nobody there, totally closed for the winter. I get up. I get out of the car because I want to stand up and eat. I don't like to eat in the car. It's a weird thing that I have. So I'm going to get out and eat in front of the sign. I walk over to the sign, look down. There's my hat laying right under the Kelder sign, a mile from where I lost it. And you got to realize we left there probably 1-2 o'clock in the morning. We come back as soon as we wake up, get some food in us. And there's no tire tracks. There's like nobody has been, like the only tire tracks we saw was from us driving, you know, probably 6-7 hours earlier in the day. And I did not get out. Maybe I did. And in all the excitement, I forgot. But Vicky and I don't remember me getting out at Kelder the other time we visited it that night. And somehow that hat gets from the side of the light to where I found it at Kelder. And I mean, I still have that hat. Like I took it with me. It's like, that's now my lucky artifact.
Sure.
And,
yeah.
You know, I've left it in restaurants and it always comes back to me. Like I left it in a restaurant recently, went back to that restaurant the next day, still hanging on the hook. So it's like, so now I have my lucky Huldufolk hat. And you know, the couple of things that I regret about that is I usually, when I go to investigate a case, I take equipment, trap cam, anything I can get my hands on, if I need to get a drone, if I need to get a camera. And we were on vacation, so we came tongue-in-cheek, not expecting to see what we ended up seeing. And of course, you know, that's how I think these things play with you, is they're going to F with you when you least expect to see them. Yeah, yeah. Or at least that's the way I rationalize it. If I'd been out there with all of my equipment, I wouldn't have seen a damn thing, probably.
I agree. There's something there's know. Something very yeah, and I trickster, people throw that word around a lot, but there is something very trickstery about the thing, the whole phenomenon.
Exactly, and I agree with that. But I did get, you know, unlike a lot of folks, I did get a handful of pictures.
Is it okay to share what you sent?
Please, I would love feedback on this. If somebody, I have had some other friends who've done analysis on that. They, you know, one guy did some sort of color pattern analysis, and he said that it looked like that the readings he got back was that it was definitely fire. It wasn't electric light. Blow it up. There's no foam pole. If you want, I can probably even find the original files off the camera and figure out a way to get them to you so they don't have to be emailed. I am desperate for feedback on that because this has like been the enduring mystery of my career, and that's sort of what got me into mystery lights. So I've been, since that time, sort of trying to match up mystery light sightings with other phenomena. And what I am finding is that mystery lights and these alb creatures, Pukwudgies in Massachusetts, our Albatwitch in York County, Huldufolk, they're sort of comorbid with bright lights, with these weird lights.
Yeah.
They all seem to have kind of a route. If you sort of draw a map of where these phenomena occur, it's sort of an arc around the Atlantic Ocean from Brittany in France, England, Scotland, not so much in Wales, a little bit, Ireland, the Faroe Islands, Iceland, Newfoundland. There's a famous place where they think Huldufolk live in Newfoundland, right down to sort of southern Pennsylvania, and then it sort of peters out, you know, around the Chesapeake Bay. And then there's a Pukwudgie tradition that's gone inland into Ohio at Moundsville State out there. But, you know, there's this sort of ancient tradition of these little people who are remarkably similar, whether they're being seen by Native Americans or Picts or Vikings or Anglo settlers in York County, that are shockingly similar and all seem to have sort of a name that's rooted in that same sort of German noun.
It's alb in German, it's alf in the Norse, it is
correct.
Yeah, of course, elf in English.
Exactly. And one of the things that I find interesting is that they do appear in the context of these sort of bizarre lights. you know, as a skeptic, as a person of science, the question that I have, and that is sort of the enduring mystery for me, is, are these sort of natural lights a physical phenomena that people are explaining away with a mythology? Or is there a mythology that the rational mind is trying to unpack scientifically by swamp gas or, you know, whatever?
Well, the folklore is incredibly consistent. That's the thing.
And that's what is, as an anthropology person, as an anthropologist, you know, that's the thing that I find particularly interesting, is that it's, I mean, man, for this to have a, for this to be a sort of a pan-Genesis folklore that starts in Europe and spreads to the New World via Columbian exchange and colonialism is really difficult for me to accept, because we do have pre-Columbian, you know, stories about these little people. And that's one of the things that I'm trying to do, is sort of collect those stories and see if you can find sort of the tale that started them all.
Yeah, I mean, I, good luck. I mean, it'd be awesome if you could, but...
Yeah, it, not possible, but...
It seems like they just pop up everywhere.
What I find interesting about the Albatwitch is, it is, you know, I think you sort of caught it, and a lot of us sort of caught it before it became an internet phenomenon. Like, it doesn't really have a Reddit thread yet.
Right.
So, and it's very, very unique to some specific places, and it's also extremely similar to the Pukwudgie legends that are just right up the coast in New Hampshire, and that are found in the area of the Huckamuck Swamp. So mm-hmm. we're talking about people who are 3-4 feet tall. I mean, they... You know, we kind of, I guess we call them baby Bigfoot, but they really look like the hula folk that you see. And, you know, they're little, you know, I'm, you can't see me, but I'm holding my hand, and they're little people.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And that's what I think is really interesting. So you kind of have to wonder if, I mean, that's, you know, cultural merging. Did the Germans bring these sort of stories with them? And, you know, I'm German, of German descent myself. You know, I'm a Mennonite on my father's mother's side, but not Lancaster Amish. The Mennonites also settled in Mexico and Texas, and I'm from that bunch. Goshen, Indiana is where a lot of our family settled as well. And we don't have an analogous story in Mennonite culture down there. I mean, there's a lot of ghost stories, but there's not any, you know, elvish stories, because I don't think there was any phenomenon down in the Texas Panhandle that these old Germans could sort of latch onto. So they sort of brought their ghost legends with them, which merge in with, you know, the local tales of La Llorona and some of that. You know, we have a German version of La Llorona and that kind of thing.
Oh, really?
So, yeah. I mean, there's rich folklore there, but, you know, one of my other interests is, whenever I get bored with work, I'm writing a couple of books, and one of them is on this concept called panic. You know, everybody knows the word panic, but nobody knows where that word comes from. And the word panic, actually, the root of it is Pan, which is the great god from Greek mythology, and the ancient phenomenon of panic was this situation where you would be alone in the woods and you suddenly get a creeping fear. And I'm sure as a woodsman you've had that yourself. If you hike in the woods a lot, you'll be walking along and all of a sudden, you know, the hair will stand up on the back of your neck, your heart will start to race, you'll start to get a cold sweat, and you don't know why, because nothing has changed. And if you're in a really weird place, all of a sudden everybody else, all the other creatures in the wood, get the same feeling, and everything goes silent, and then you really start to freak out. That's what the Greeks called panic, and it was because you were supposedly walking up onto Pan's dinner table, and where he would have his, you know, sort of fets out in the woods, and that's where we get that word from. And it's analogous to stories of fae folk. These people would be walking in the woods, and they would all of a sudden start to freak out, and they would turn and look, and they were in a fairy ring. You know, you hear all these awful stories about if you dance with the fairies or eat their food, you'll be stuck in their realm for a long time. So this is not a phenomenon that we've created over the last 100 years or 200 years or even 1,000 years. This is something that the Greeks and ancient people, you know, already had a full-blown mythology for, that we've, you know, sort of inherited down and are sort of trying to reconcile it in our own culture. And it's, you know, the phenomenon is real. My interest is what's the cause of it. You know, right. I saw a mystery light. Maybe that mystery light was a spaceship. Maybe it was a dude in an F-150. I don't think it was, because that would have been possible. You know, and is all I can say is that I saw it. I took a picture of it. The picture's not a hoax, and I don't know what the hell it is. So So I want to go to places where we have mystery lights and see if I can figure out, see if I can replicate that. And it may be a fool's errand. You know, I've gone down to Brown Mountain now. We recently saw a very strange light over in Seven Valleys, which seems to be a mecca for strange lights, but I wasn't able to get a picture of it. It was like a flash. Mm. I think we've talked about this. I think what you and I call the white flash is sort of different. I think you're seeing a flash of movement, and what my wife and I have seen is more like the lit up field that I think you've described a few times.
Yeah. Now, when I saw a little, I mean, mine was lit up not temporarily. It was like stadium lights.
That's the way you've described it. I would kill to see that. We were in Seven Valleys out at a cemetery one night, and we had that. It was literally, you know, 2 seconds, clear as day. The light was coming from the ground, not the sky, you know, and that we were explicitly out there exploring for that kind of stuff. To see it light up like stadium lights, I mean, I can't even imagine what that was.
The Seven Valley stuff, a lot of people talk about green or kind of golden lights out there,
yes,
which is extremely fascinating. The flash, I don't know if you heard, we did a show on lights on Where Did the Road Go recently, and
yes,
they were talking about those flashes like that a lot.
And I don't know what it is. You know, I've seen them twice now, and both times it was in Seven Valleys, and they come from the ground up, so it's not lightning. Like, you know, I've seen lightning. it's ever present. It's from the ground up, and it doesn't have a single point. It is a light that's everywhere all at once. So,
I have a woman, a very, very nice woman. She doesn't have internet access. She found me. I took an ad out in the paper that just said, like, seen anything weird, Bigfoot, anything like that. So that's how she found me. So she calls me every now and then. She'll call me, you know, once every 2 to 3 months or something. And she'll just, she's a local lady who's been collecting these stories. I'm guessing, I don't know her age. I'm guessing she's in her 60s or 70s just from her voice and from how many stories she has and how far they date back. But she'll call me every couple months. She called me, like one of the first times she called me, she told me the story about these glowing fields. And she's from Seven Valleys. This was on her family's property. Her father went out and saw this field lit up glowing. I traced the date back. I said, what date was it? And it was, she said it was September. And I forget, it was sometime in the early 80s. I'll say 82, but I'm not exactly sure what year it was. But anyway, I found within a week. Now, she knew nothing about Bigfoot. She wasn't interested in Bigfoot at all. She just told me about these glowing fields, and that the following day, after her father saw it, there were black helicopters flying around the area. Yeah. I think she even said one landed in that field, but I'll have to look at my notes to be sure. But anyway, I found a Bigfoot sighting within days of the day her father saw this field in Seven Valleys.
Man, that's incredible. You know, we've had some UFO sightings in and around. There was one at near the paper factory, I think it was in the early 80s, and there's been a couple. You guys investigated one. There's been a few. You know, I don't work on defense projects, so I'm not a quote-unquote disinformation agent or anything like that. I don't know anything about UFOs, and I never talk to people about stuff that I actually do work on, so I have no insight into the UFO phenomenon.
The fact that you just denied it means there's a certain percentage of people out there going, uh-huh.
Yeah, I know, of course. This will make it worse, but information science is my specialty, you know, so information, disinformation, and propaganda are sort of things that I actually lecture about and stuff like that. So, you know, if I were going to make up a story, I'd be the guy to do it. That's why I'm not doing it. And I have to tell people, you know, I could tell you everything I really work on in the context of sitting in a bar, and you'd never believe it because it would all sound crazy. But I don't know anything about black projects or anything like that. But where we are in Pennsylvania is awfully close to where the government does an awful lot of military testing.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm always sort of skeptical of UFOs a little bit, but the government, I'm pretty sure, is not working on Bigfoot. That's, I don't know about missing 911 and all that stuff, but that one, you know, we might stare at goats and stuff like that, but I'm not sure about that. I think I don't know what's going on, but I think something's going on, and I'm not sure. I have no idea what it is, and that's why it's exciting.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Getting back to the Iceland story, did you say there was one of these elf houses in the area that you saw the light?
Yes, I sent you a picture of it. I think it's tagged Elf House Kelder.
Okay.
And it's a picture of it's a little house. It's very old with a spring pouring out the front door.
Wow.
And again, you're welcome. And that's, my hat would have been found. I could have picked up the hat and thrown it and hit that thing.
Oh, okay.
The place where we saw the light would have been about half a mile to a mile away from there.
Okay, wow.
But again, we're talking about a farm on a plain, completely devoid of trees, exclusively for caribou, you know, farming with no people living on it. So, I mean, this is not a place. Again, on a night where a person out walking would have not been able to walk that distance without some serious health effects. Like, it was like we were literally feeling the effects just from standing outside eating cheese and crackers. So,
and it's interesting to me though that you know, your elves, we were saying, so they don't have the idea of the fairy fort in Iceland, but they're building houses specifically for them.
Correct.
And they're building roads. They will actually avoid certain mounds and stuff, and like you said, they'll move the roads or they won't build through areas because they're known, you know, they were known as where the elves were. In fact, I think I read it was in that book, the Elves, Wights, and Trolls book. There's a story in there about a World War II air base they were building. I don't know if it's the same one you were mentioning before.
Oh yes, that is the place.
And they delayed the building of that for about a month, and it was the Americans were very, very frustrated. But the Icelandic people were like, no, we're not. One of the fellows actually got a message in a dream, I think. That came to him and said, please give us time to move before you tear down this hill or this mound or whatever it was. So this idea does exist, you know, more than Ireland, more than Scotland, of these homes, these places, you know, a lot of times are associated with springs. That's why that house built on the spring.
That house is built on the spring.
Yeah.
And that's where I think, I mean, we've just come full circle. That's why I think the fairy forts are associated with fairies. And, you know, the Puckwudgies live in rocks. The Albatwitches live on Chicky's Rock. I think that because there are not, you know, in Iceland, they live on big rocks. They live in these craggy places, caves underground. But in Scotland, Ireland, there's not those kind of features. So I think that these things have become associated with ancient structures.
You know, what we call Hex Hollow is actually also known as Spring Valley.
Yep.
And the reason why is there are an incredible amount of natural springs there. If you spend any amount of time hiking through there, you'll see them. They pop up in the woods at various locations.
The groundwater is very, you know, the water table is very close to the surface there.
Yeah. There's a reason why it's called Hex Hollow too. But I believe it's a very special place. But the proper name is Spring Valley, and it's absolutely deserving of that name. There's springs everywhere.
You know, this is one of those places. You know, I go back to sort of this theory of panic, like you know, the first time we ever, you know, and again, I encourage people not to go to Toad Road. Like that is that is private property. You know, and I don't even like to slow my car down there because then everybody on that thing knows what you're doing. And, you know, and I mean, if you want to find your kids on a Saturday night, drive out there because it seems like there's a billion teenagers out there all the time. So don't go out there unless you have permission from somebody. But it's one of those places that as soon as you get out of your car, you're like, man, this place is weird. Like it is Cadore's Furnace. It's weird. And Hex Hollow is one of those places that as soon as you get out, it's what they call a liminal space. It's like a place where, you know, we intuitively understand that this is a different kind of place than a normal piece of real estate. Like you're never going to find a beach resort in Hex Hollow because it just doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel unpleasant, but it doesn't feel right either. I don't know if you've had the similar experience, but, you know.
Well, my most intense, you know, if you want to talk about panic, my most intense panic in the woods was there.
Really?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
At Hex Hollow? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Man, I could believe that because that place is really strange.
It was, I mean, there was no good reason. Well, I mean, I've talked about it before. That's where I heard the, you know, what I thought was a rock clack, and then I heard what I thought was wood knock, and then smelled something and thought for, you know, it's had all the markings of a Bigfoot sighting when I got no sighting.
Sure.
But it accompanied that, and absolutely terrified. I couldn't move. My knees were locked.
You know, the only time I've ever had an experience like that was not in York County. I feel very at home in York County, and that's why we chose to move there. And I mean, we've been to some wacky places, and you know, places that your listeners don't ever need to go to. But we were exploring. There is a very tiny legend of mystery lights. This will be interesting to your viewers because they can go and listeners because they can go and explore this one outside Orlando, Florida. And one of probably the older Mystery Light stories in the United States took place outside Orlando, and it became probably almost as old as Brown Mountain. It became such a tourist attraction in the 1950s, where people were going out and seeing this thing, that they had to, you know, send the sheriff out to send people home. There were so many people going out to look at that a young man actually got ran over by a car and killed. And after that, they started downplaying it as a tourist attraction. So, you know, Vicky and I were at, she was at the American Library Association conference a couple of years back. I got it into my head that I didn't want to be in Washington, D.C. for a week, so I went with her. And there's, if you don't like Disney World, by the way, there's not a lot to do in Orlando. So we went out to, I drug her out to this place in the middle of the night, thinking it would be sort of our standard, get out with the cameras, you know, look around, spend the night sort of sitting on the hood of the car and just keeping a lookout. Brother, we got out of that car and we both just had, like, it was probably the most upset I think I have felt as an adult. Again, my knees locked, I'm bald, and the little bit of hair I still have on my head stood up. I went from hot sweat to cold sweat, and it just, Vicky and I both, she was like, man, I do not like this place. And we were right off the side of a county highway. We were both like, this is a bad place. Some bad things have happened here. This is whatever we see is not going to leave us with a lucky hat kind of experience. This is going to be a bad experience. We had driven an hour to get there. We got back in that car, turned around and left, and went back to our Airbnb. I mean, we've been in the catacombs. We've been in the Edinburgh vaults. We've been into some, you know, backcountry Arizona or New Mexico and all that stuff. You know, we've been to some shady places on our investigation, and I have never had one that left me that scared. And there was nothing there but a swamp and a highway. And I mean, whatever the boundary is between that piece of real estate and call it the other side or whatever, it's very thin in that place. And nobody had built a house there. I mean, it was good real estate right outside Orlando. There weren't any houses.
You didn't see any lights or anything.
We didn't stay long enough.
Right. Yeah.
We didn't stick around. We were there for about 25 minutes and just had enough. Like, it was a creepy place. Again, you know, this is an area where people were building million-dollar homes to be right outside Orlando. And basically for a mile on either side of this river, it was desolate. There was nothing there. And it was a very disconcerting place. But it's a place, you know, you can go investigate. If you get bored with Disney World, Google it. Google Mystery Light Orlando. And you can go out and check it out. We did not see a light on that trip. We did see a light at Brown Mountain, though. We did see a light that I can't explain, despite what some of my skeptical colleagues think.
Was it basically what people report there?
It was. We were there all night hanging out in the middle of winter in last October. And we found the very best outlook we could find. Perfect viewing, clean, crisp weather. It was before the winter season and after the summer season. Set up on this sort of picnic bench and just sat there, you know, stone cold watching. It took about an hour to identify all the city lights. You know, that's clearly a car. That's clearly a hiker. That's clearly, you know, an antenna, blah, blah, blah. We made notes about that. And, you know, towards the end of our period there, we saw a light that we're probably a mile away from Brown Mountain across this valley that emanated off the side of the mountain, extended itself toward us, swelled to the size of a quarter. So this is something that's not on the mountain. It's coming out from the mountain, increases in size as it moves away from the mountain, and then flickers out. So it couldn't have been an airplane. It couldn't have been an ATV. It was clearly something that, you know, to me it looked like what I would call a burst of plasma, something that came out, lit up, and it's the closest thing that we've personally seen to what we saw in Iceland. Though based on the distance, it would have been somewhat larger. Well, didn't get a picture of it, but we definitely saw it, and we definitely, you know, noted it on Facebook at the time.
I'll have to get you to sign a non-disclosure thing and then agree to be hoodwinked, but I'll have to take you to Site 7. And show you those, because they don't look like they're not man-made at first. To me, I'm you know, when I first, well, first of all, you have to let your eyes adjust. So they're not super, super bright, although they will get super bright when you start messing with them. But in their sort of, I'll say, natural state or whatever, they're not super bright, but they're bright enough where, you know, once your eyes adjust to the dark, you see them. And then I'm looking at him, I'm thinking, it's got to be something man-made. There's something that, you know, they look like, you know, they were that whitish blue of a, like a LED kind of light. And I'm like, nah, it's man-made until they start moving and changing colors. Then I'm like, I don't know how to explain that.
That's, again, these two lights that I've seen, you know, that Vicky and I have seen were exactly like that. They were too regular to be, I don't know, people describe will-o'-the-wisps. I mean, they must be will-o'-the-wisps, whatever the hell that is. They look man-made. They behave like a device, like a machine, but then they don't.
Right.
They behave like plasma under the command of an intelligence. They're both mechanical and organic, and that's exactly what we saw in Iceland and
That's a good explanation, a good description. And someone wrote, and they said, I know what you saw. You saw light reflecting off of water, and the water was dripping, and that explains the movement. And this guy was very confident. I said, well, maybe, but the lights were moving up and sideways, and, you know, water doesn't move that way. So, I don't know what to you know, it would be a good possible explanation, however unlikely, but, you know, maybe. But water doesn't move up and sideways. It just doesn't, like, gravity doesn't work that way.
That's an area where I break with a lot of my skeptical colleagues. I don't think you can explain these things on Reddit from your house. You want to investigate these phenomena, you have to go investigate them. I was an armchair skeptic for a long time, and then I realized that was really, you know, that's almost mental masturbation, where you're playing Sherlock Holmes, you don't have any of the evidence, and that's why we really started investigating cases, because, number one, it's fun. I mean, let's admit it's fun. But number two, if you really want to know the answer, you can't know it unless you see the circumstances. And a lot of people have debunked, you know, Brown Mountain, for instance, after going out there and sitting for 35 minutes and going, well, that's an airplane. Well, yeah, there are airplanes. I mean, you know, that area of North Carolina has a lot of people, and Brown Mountain has hikers on it. But after you just keep your eyes focused on that thing, hour one, hour two, hour three, you begin to see the pattern of human movement and of machines moving. And that gives you an understanding of what happens when anomalous phenomena show up. One thing I will say, anybody can research Brown Mountain, and I would encourage them to do that. There's a guy who lives on the mountain who posts YouTube video every night. He's got a couple of cameras running. He picks up crazy lights all the time. And he, you know, posts them up there, you know, 8, 9, 10 hours of footage so that people can sit there on YouTube and look at them. And I have seen some footage of the exact same thing that Vicky and I saw. They occur with enough regularity for this to be an identifiable phenomena. And I will say that I'm not crazy. There's a skeptical investigator, she's more of a skeptic than I am, named Sharon Hill, who lives up in Harrisburg, who's a geologist for the state of Pennsylvania, who also thinks that these lights, you know, are a real phenomena. I'll say it, I don't believe in ghosts. And I think Bigfoot is something, but I don't think it's an ape in the woods.
I agree, yeah.
You know, and if space aliens exist, that's probably the Department of Defense. But these mystery lights are real. And they are a phenomenon that we have not fully understood. And, you know, so that's why I've kind of planted my flag on there.
Jerry, thanks so much for telling your stories.
Big fan of the show. I absolutely love this podcast. Thank you for all the hours of entertainment. I'm happy to be on.
Oh, thanks for coming on.
Sure.
Before we get on with the rest of the show, I'd just like to mention, if you like what we do on Strange Familiars, please consider becoming a patron. Go to patreon.com/strangefamiliars. We try to do full extra shows every month for our patrons. Last month, we actually did 2 full shows. This month, we'll have a special guest telling us about his Bigfoot encounters, as well as discussing Bigfoot, Albatwitch, and other hairy creatures with me. We do not have advertisers. We don't have grants. We don't have any financial support other than our patrons. So if you want to help us out, $3 a month gets you extra shows and other content. You can go in at higher levels for more rewards and get things like t-shirts, stickers, pins, and more. Thanks to all of our current patrons. We really couldn't do the show without you. And if you'd like to help, that's patreon.com/strangefamiliars. We're talking with Matt, who had a UFO experience in the Sierras, right? Sierra Mountains.
Yeah, Sierra Nevada Mountains.
And
right outside Lake Tahoe.
So what year was this?
This was 2001, the summer. And I think all of us, when we think of the year 2001, since what happened that year, and I specifically remember this is the summer before 9/11. So, you know, a long time ago, but time does fly, and it's crazy that's been that long.
So what were you doing there? Was it vacation, or are you just hanging out, or?
No, actually, one of my good friends in high school told me about a job working up at a summer camp, which was run by the city of Berkeley, where I'm from, in the Bay Area. But the city of Berkeley ran a youth summer camp for families and also kids. And my friend had worked there the summer before, just doing some random maintenance work. So I jumped at the opportunity just to basically get out of the house for the summer, get away, make a little bit of money. And also at the same time, you know, go up in the mountains, a place that I have always loved. Most of my life, I would go camping with my family up around the Tahoe area in the summertime. So it's a place that I love because it's so beautiful up there.
Yeah, I've not been, but I've seen plenty of pictures. I've been north of San Francisco. I've been to Muir Woods and all that, but I've never gotten into the Sierra Nevadas.
In the Bay Area, everybody, you know, talks about, oh, let's go up to Tahoe for the summer, or let's go skiing, you know, in the winter. So it's a pretty well-known destination for people from the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. Anybody who hasn't been there, I definitely recommend it. It's a beautiful lake. Yeah, if you get a chance, definitely go there someday.
Yeah, it's on my list. I have sort of a list of places I need to hike, and that's definitely one of them.
You're in Pennsylvania?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm sure you have a lot of avenues to pursue in terms of whether it's UFO or cryptozoology, because I know I've heard a lot of stories about Pennsylvania and the history, you know?
We get a lot here and a crazy mix of stuff, too. So, yeah, there's plenty to look for here. But my listeners are all over the place, so I try not to do – I mean, I'm here, so I end up doing mostly in Pennsylvania, but I try to spread out and do other stuff, too, which is good. It's good you're on. So kind of lead us into what happened. Presumably, this was at night.
Yeah, it was at nighttime. I was working up at this camp for about 7 weeks, and there was a lot of – you know, classmates around my age that were working there too. So a lot of people I knew that were from Berkeley that worked up there on the staff and a lot of cool people. You know, we'd hang out after work and just, you know, hang out and have fun, stuff like that. And this one particular night, we were gathering, just hanging out, and we decided to go to this beautiful spot on the ridge. It's this ridge on basically like the western side of the Lake Tahoe Valley, and it overlooks, like, looking east towards Lake Tahoe and Nevada, and it's a good spot to have a nice view and just, you know, relax and stuff and do what teenagers do. So yeah, this specific night we went out there and just hung out, and that's when we saw something pretty interesting in the sky and definitely caught our eye, and it was something that I we all saw. I don't remember exactly how many people were with us, but I think I remember it was like 10 to 12. So it was a good bunch of us.
Yeah, that's a good group of people. Now did you, I'm just remembering from your email you sent, did you say you saw it first?
I don't know if I saw it first, but okay. I do remember when I did see it, I pointed it out to everybody. And then so I know at that point, everybody was watching this thing in the sky. And it gives me kind of like a reassurance a little bit to know it wasn't just me seeing it.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. So that definitely made it more of a powerful moment, you know, that I was able to talk to other people right after it happened and just like in shock in a way and just kind of in awe, like, what the heck was that, you know?
Yeah, when I go out into the woods alone and if I'm doing recording, I always point out to people, it's so much easier and nicer just to have someone else there, even just to say,
yeah,
did you see that too? Like, are we talking about the same thing? Now, what did you see? And, you know, you sort of check each other with that.
Seriously. Man, going out in the woods alone, that's, I don't know if I could do that, but I definitely commend and applaud the people that have that kind of ambition, you know, if they're alone, that they'll still go out there. I don't know if I could do that. So I guess I'll continue with.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So yeah, we were just hanging out in this cluster of rocks on this ridge overlooking the east of the Tahoe Valley. And it's this, we call it the pipeline because there's just this big I guess it's a drainage pipe that runs along the ridge. So we're just hanging out there. And I remember it was a pretty clear night because we saw a bunch of stars and stuff. And definitely up in that elevation, it's really, really clear. So getting away from the city, you could see all the stars and the satellites and all that. It's just an amazing view at night. We're looking east, and something caught my eye. It was in the air east of us. I don't know how high it was. I don't know exactly how big it was. But to give you a little reference, you know, you're looking at a clear sky in the nighttime, and you see the stars. And if you just, you know, point your thumb up in the sky, you can block out, you know, the stars and stuff like that. But, you know, like, so when I put my thumb up for, like, reference, like, how big this thing was, because it wasn't a little dot like a satellite. It wasn't a shooting star. So it was something a little bit bigger, and it was probably a lot closer to where we were at. And so basically this thing kind of just appeared like a round ball of light. I can't really say that it was any saucer shape or anything, but definitely round ball kind of thing. And it was pretty close to us, and it was, you know, definitely bigger than a little speck of a star, you know, so it had some size to it. And the colors, when I look back at my memory, like, I get all these different colors, but it was mostly like red, orange, a little bit of yellow, and I think there was also hints of green too, so pretty bright. And it was definitely something that caught my eye. I don't know exactly who else saw it when I first saw it, but I remember seeing it and then pointing at it, like, look at that, look at that. So it was up in the, I don't know exactly when it first appeared, but when I first noticed it, I was able to look at it for myself for a split second and then say to everybody else and point my finger, like, hey, look at that, guys. I'm pretty sure at this moment, everybody was looking at it. And like I said, there was at least 10 of us.
That's a good crowd of people. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, it is.
That would
it
be
is.
Really interesting. That'd be one of the things MUFON or those organizations would really like to note, that, you know, 10 separate witnesses.
Yeah, yeah. And it also, yeah, just gives it more credibility. And to come to think of it, I haven't really talked to anybody, some of my friends. You know how you grow up and you live different lives and you don't see, you know, just people move on. But so I was thinking, like, dang, I'd like to really talk to some of those friends that was there and just try to pick their brain on what they remember, because I know they saw it too, and I know they remember it. And there's a few of those guys that I haven't talked to in a while, but I can get in contact too and just, like, to pick their brain. Someday I'll do that. Just hasn't happened in a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
But I do remember talking to one of my other friends about this, and this is a couple years ago, and he was there too. And I don't know what we were talking about. We were just hanging out at his house, and I just brought that time. Hey, remember when we saw that UFO? And it was definitely something that he remembered, and we talked about it for a little bit, and just like, yeah, that was crazy. So at this point, I first see it when it first appeared. I don't know how long it was in the air, but when I first saw it and told everybody else, it was probably a good second and a half at least, maybe more. And then all of a sudden, it just kind of comes towards us, which is west. And we're looking east, so it comes a little bit towards us, which is west. Split, you know, so fast, and there's no sound, you know, so it's not like an airplane that, because there's an airport nearby. It wasn't an airplane. It wasn't a shooting star, because shooting stars definitely don't maneuver like that. It wasn't a satellite, anything. Anyway, so it kind of shoots over towards us. So it's coming west. Really fast too, really fast, like split second fast, and it's like you kind of can see streaks of the light, but it's like right there, kind of like hovering around our area above us. And when this happened, we were all like, whoa. And then there was, like, in the whole area where we're sitting at, it kind of seemed like it did illuminate a little bit. So it shoots over towards us, we all look up, and there's a bunch of colors. It's a round circle, big ball, orange, red, some yellowish, some green even too. And it kind of, yeah, like I said, it kind of looked like it illuminated our area. So it wasn't, you know, maybe just that the light that it had on its source kind of lit up the whole area. I don't think it was like just shooting like a beam of light. I think it was just more of just the overall ambience of the light like carried over towards our area, so it kind of lit us up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I remember it. I would love to pick the brains of some of my friends and just about that aspect, but I haven't, you know, like I said, it's been years and haven't talked to people in a while.
When you talk about the different colors, were they like individual sort of lights on it, or did it change colors,
That's a good question. No, it seems like it just they all kind of like blended in to the just one color. There wasn't any specific, you know, lights. You know, it was kind of like all blended in as one color.
So the whole time, this just appears as sort of a ball of light.
Yeah.
For lack of a better description. Yeah. Okay.
Basically, just a ball of light. I mean, yeah, I don't remember seeing any like real structure to it. You know,
mm-hmm.
like saucer structure or any other kind of like aircraft kind of structure. I didn't see any of that. It was more just like a haze of a ball of light, you know. So it came towards our area, kind of lit up the area a little bit, and we all looked up, and I think everybody saw this. I mean, everybody saw this. And then in the next like split second, it jetted and was gone. And I kind of remember it went like back towards where it came from a little bit, towards the east, like southeast, and it was gone, you know.
Never
just
saw
like
it
that,
again.
It was gone. No, never saw it again. And, you know, a lot of us were probably just like didn't know what to say, you know? It's like, what? That was crazy, you know?
Sure, yeah. Did you notice anything else weird that night? Any, you know, any other kind of missing time or anything like that?
I don't think I do. No, mm-hmm. I mean, what I remember is just seeing that thing. Before, I don't remember anything strange about that night. Weather-wise or anything like that, time-wise. So I can't really pinpoint any other precursors to that necessarily.
Right. When it came towards you, was it sort of directly overhead? Were you looking straight up? Or
it was basically directly overhead. Yeah, it was pretty much directly overhead. And I think about this sometimes, and I'm like, wow, what if it was just like me there? Or what if it was just two people there? You hear about these people that have been abducted. I mean, I'm open-minded about everything, and I believe a lot of people that say that. Like, I don't know off the top of my head any real famous cases, but I know that there have been a lot of them.
Oh, yeah.
And so you think about that, it's like, wow, what if it was just me up there? I mean, maybe it would have wanted to do more and just hover around or whatever. The fact that there was a bunch of us probably deterred it. You know, it wanted to go come check us out. Get out of there once it knew there was a bunch of people. Something like that, you know.
Yeah,
I don't believe
although I've heard stories where, you know, whole parties full of people have been, not necessarily abducted, but like the, you know, one or two people will be abducted, the rest of them will be put to sleep kind of thing. They'll have no memory of it. So there's all kinds of weirdness. I mean, I think you're right. I think probably a bunch of people is safer than one or two, but whatever those things are, you know, call them aliens for lack of a better word, They do what they want to do, you know, no matter how many people are there.
Yeah.
It seems like their technology or whatever it is that they're using is so far advanced from what we have that they seem to be able to do whatever they want, according to stories. You know, again, this is
According to stories. And I mean, I'm definitely a believer in a lot of that, like in terms of the knowledge and the wisdom that we lost thousands of years ago. There's definitely something to that. And for instance, like, I went to Egypt when I went to Giza, and I saw the big pyramids. And, you know, coming back from the from Egypt, and it just made me want to study more about that subject. And, like, we don't even know how they built those pyramids today, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like,
they've got some guesses, but yeah, no one's really.
They've got some guesses, I know, but it's like.
Yeah.
So I'm really open minded to all of that historical mysteries and. Whether they're aliens or giants, or we just don't know. And I think you got to be open-minded about that.
Sure.
Because we just don't know.
So the rest of that time that you were in the mountains there, or other times when you were camping or anything, did you ever experience anything else strange, any screams or weird stuff like that?
There are two other times that I had some. It was nothing that I saw, but it was just what I felt. So I'll start with one time. I moved to Tahoe to live up there for a couple years in late 2006, and I stayed there until like basically around 2009.
Mm-hmm.
So this is like years after 2001 when I first saw that strange thing in the sky. So I was living up there with, you know, my cousin was there. He was a ski instructor, and I was there working at a restaurant. And this is this one night I was coming back up to Tahoe late at night. This is probably like 2 o'clock in the morning. I was down in the Bay Area, and I had to work the next day up in Tahoe. So I was making basically like a 3-hour trip from Berkeley up to Tahoe in the middle of the night. And, you know, I started to get tired when I got onto the Highway 50, which is one of the roads that goes east up to Tahoe. And this is like a real windy mountain road. Mm-hmm. And so I was getting really tired and kind of swerving a little bit. So I decided just to pull over and maybe get like a half an hour of sleep and just so I can make it home. Cause it was still from there, it was still like a good 30 miles to my house up in Tahoe. So I decided to pull over, and I remember it was, yeah. So I had the windows open. So it must've been the summertime, cause it can get kind of chilly up there. Definitely in the wintertime. Highway 50 is this mountain road. It stretches for about 25, 30 miles, windy mountain roads through the Sierra Nevadas. Like I said, I was pulled over, just needed to like get a little bit of sleep because I didn't want to drive anymore because I was swerving.
Sure, yeah.
And I remember, you know, I had the windows open and I was just laying down trying to close my eyes for a little bit, not really feeling anything, just trying to get some sleep. And really just out of nowhere, I just had this sudden sense of like fear or dread or whatever you want to call it. But it just like, it kind of like woke me up a little bit. And I was like, I looked around, didn't see anything because it's dark and there's no real road lights. And at that time, there's like no traffic because it was like, I think it was like 2 o'clock in the morning. So yeah, something just said, I just get out of there. And so I did. I just got out of there because I just had this feeling of fear. I couldn't really explain it.
I think I know the feeling.
Yeah, so, you know, it's just something to say, just get out of here.
Yeah.
And because I had the fear, just like, I'm leaving. I don't know what it was. I just want to go. I will add, like, to that, there has been a few sightings over the years on that Highway 50 of Bigfoot crossing the road, stuff like that. They're on, like, the BFRO website. I've looked them up before. I don't know when the most recent one was, but it's happened multiple times. And so that was basically that first time where I really felt just a fear. And there's another time it was the exact same thing, but it was a little bit different situation. I wasn't driving. I was actually kind of stranded in South Lake Tahoe. I was at the casinos with some friends, and then somehow my ride fell through, and then I wound up having to basically just walk all the way back to my house, which is basically, I'd say, 5 or 6 miles outside of the town a little bit. This is basically the same thing. I just had a sense of fear rush over me. It was snowing a little bit, so there was snow on the ground in winter time, pretty cold, and it was pretty late at night, like probably around 12 or 1, not really any traffic around. And I'm walking towards my house, and I make it like almost all the way there. So I walked about 4, maybe 5 miles, and made a turn onto the road where my house was. It's kind of like on the outskirts of the main part of South Lake Tahoe, so it's pretty, you know, there's not many houses around, there's not much traffic, there's not many street lights, there's a lot of patches of just forest, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I remember making a turn up to my house up the street, and the same kind of thing happened. Like, there on the right of me, there's a good, you know, like probably a 2-city block area of just straight forest, you know, no houses, just a bunch of trees, and pitch black in there too, you know. And even where I'm walking it, there's not much light. There's only street lights every block or so, maybe. So it's pretty dark. So I'm walking and I look towards the whole patch of forest, like I told you, and it's pitch black in there. And I look in there and I just like, the same thing happens. I don't see anything. I don't smell anything. I didn't hear anything. I just had a straight fear come over me. I don't know what it was. And at that moment, I started running as fast as I could to my house. There might not be anything to this, but it's something I definitely remember. And
no, but it's interesting that the 4 miles previous. So it wasn't that you were walking in the dark, because here you've walked in the dark for, you know, 3/4 of the way or more.
Yeah.
Already. And then it hits you, you know, in this one section. That's interesting.
Yeah. So it was something that I've thought about before, and like, there's got to be something to that. I mean, why would I just out of blue just go crazy and run home like, you know, like you're gonna die or something? You know, just that fear.
Yeah.
It was weird.
That's interesting though. Yeah.
This area in the Sierra Nevadas mountains, I'm sure you probably know, but like, there's been a lot of weird things that have happened there in terms of like plane crashes and stuff like that. A lot of people call it like the Nevada Triangle, which is basically like, you could basically map it out with Reno, Nevada, Las Vegas, and then also Fresno, California.
Okay.
So those three cities, basically, this one documentary I saw was pointing it out. And, you know, there's been a lot of plane crashes over the years around there, including like famous people like Steve Fawcett.
Okay, yeah.
He had a plane crash and they didn't know what happened, but I think they finally found him.
Yeah, that was a real mystery with him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was.
I think that was the guy people were reporting, like, they saw him supposedly afterwards or something, or he came back. I'm trying to remember.
I know. I don't know all the details. I haven't really researched it too hardcore, but...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know there's a lot of strangeness around that. I don't remember the details of it, but...
So those aspects make it, you know, make the sighting more interesting. And also the proximity to Area 51. I mean, you know, whatever they got going down there in Area 51... It's definitely within short range of the Sierra Nevadas, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's maybe like a little playground to test out their toys or something.
Well, I know Ron Moorhead, he did his Bigfoot
Sierra
recordings.
Sounds.
Yeah, yep. They were up there. So, and he never used to talk about it, but lately he's been talking about how he's seen lights and stuff up there too.
And
orbs
and
such.
Yeah, and it seems like a lot of people are talking about these orbs and lights. I mean... there's definitely something going on, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Are you still in the area?
Yeah, I'm still in the Bay Area.
If you get up there and see anything else or anything else odd happens, let us know.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I definitely have some plans someday to do some investigating and stuff like that, but I just haven't really got it together, and I don't think I have enough balls to go out by myself at night.
So. Well, for me, it depends on the area. There's certain places I won't go alone.
Yeah, and I definitely want to get back to Pennsylvania someday, because I went to Gettysburg
mm-hmm.
when I was a kid, and it was the craziest thing. I come back. I mean, when I go there, I'm a little kid. I don't know what's going on with the Civil War and what's Gettysburg and blah blah blah. And so I didn't really pay attention, you know, when I was there playing around all on Devil's Den, you know, and like it's a jungle gym. And I come back and I'm just like, you know, I started to become just fascinated with the Civil War, just obsessed out of nowhere. So I have a lot of interest in definitely Pennsylvania and, you know, the Civil War or UFOs or cryptozoology and spirituality. And
yeah, if you ever get back here, drop me a line. I'll meet up and we'll go.
I definitely, yeah. And I forgot, weren't you on Wes's show once?
I've been on Sasquatch Chronicles, I think, four times now.
Yeah, because I remember, like, there was that one episode where you talked about the old stories of things in, like, around Gettysburg, like the Gettysburg Gorilla.
Yeah, mm-hmm, yep.
That was really interesting. I liked hearing about that.
Yeah, I'm about to do a show, like, some point coming up where we talk about that. I'll go over all the related articles and stuff for that whole gorilla flap.
Yeah.
The Pennsylvania gorilla flap, they call it. From the 20s, so that'll probably end up being two shows at least worth of.
I think, those old stories are so fascinating. I mean, there's so much to those times, because it's like, you know, people are just, it's basically like a young kid that they're innocent and they tell the truth because they don't know any better. And back then in those days, they didn't have all this influence of government, you know, to tell the right story and stuff, and
right or pop culture. I mean, they didn't know what a Bigfoot was. They just you know, they just told what they saw.
Yeah.
So. All right, Matt. Thank you so much.
Tim, thanks a lot. I appreciate it, and keep up the good work.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Have a good night and peace.
All right. You as well. Thanks.
Strange Familiars is a production of Dark Holler Arts. Music, books, art, podcasts, and more. DarkHollerArts.com. If you are on Facebook, check out the Strange Familiars Gathering group. We post stories and links to other podcasts we like. Listeners post their creations and discoveries, various related articles, and more. Intro and background music is by Stone Breath. Stonebreath.bandcamp.com for more.